I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 176 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast with iTunes or other podcast apps. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Remember that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you. Send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it, or don't like. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor the show as an individual or an advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com or make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. And Patreon is PATREON. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges to others. If you would like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're associated with on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. And now for a little bit of feedback. On episode 173, which was with Dr. Bob Dixon and fluoridation, Paul wrote, "Great to hear the real news about fluoride. David, thanks for exposing the lies and deception used by promoters of systemic fluoride. Great news. The lies are obvious in fluoridation promotion schemes." Chris Exley, who was interviewed in episode 170, wrote to me saying, "Thank you for the interview. However, it is not my opinion that the increasing use of aluminum, or aluminium as he says it, in vaccine adjuvants is the most likely source of the aluminum in the brain. What I did say is that that is one such possible source." So I did correct the show notes to better reflect his feelings on this. I think it's brave for him to say that it is even one possible source in an environment of vaccine absolutism. An organization called the Canadian Association for Quality in Western Ontario commented on episode 165, in which I interviewed Justin Trottier, "Keep up the great work. We'd like to have you speak in the future, David." Well, that would sure be nice. I don't know if this organization is associated with Justin Trottier or not. They're both in Ontario. On my latest interview, in which I interviewed Trisha Morrison, the widow of Tommy Morrison, Alberto wrote, "Congratulations on your new interview with Tommy's wife. Fantastic. Thanks so much for all that positive feedback. I really appreciate it, and please keep it coming." Domina L. is a current erotic service provider with 18 years in the adult entertainment industry as a professional dominatrix. She's also a board member of ESPLERP, which stands for the Erotic Service Provider Legal Education and Research Project, as well as a member of the Erotic Service Provider Union. Previous to her work as a dominatrix, she worked in holistic medicine as a body worker and says the work she does as a dominatrix is also a therapeutic modality. Elle got involved in the fight for erotic service providers' rights in 2010. Welcome to the show, Elle.
Thank you.
Well, I'm glad to have you come on the show and talk to me. And before we get to the work of the very catchy acronym of ESPLERP, I'd like...
Esplerp.
Esplerp, yeah. It's I didn't want to try to say it as one word. Don't think that would end well. So why did you pick sex work?
I like to refer to it as erotic service provision.
Okay.
I know that the term sex work has become, you know, much more popularized in recent years. And because, you know, prostitute was, you know, something that people felt was so stigmatized and wanted to humanize and also, you know, focus on the fact that this is work for many people. I like erotic service provider because it encompasses so much more. The term sex work, I mean, you have the word sex there, and not all erotic service providers are providing sex.
Mm-hmm.
Is a spectrum of vocations in the adult entertainment realm, and it's not just entertainment. There's also it's, you know, therapeutic work in many instances, even healing work in many instances, and erotic service provision, you know, covers it, I think, more accurately. As for myself, I kind of accidentally stumbled into it. I had many years in holistic medicine, and I was going through a period of my life that, it was not a good situation, but I found that people actually requested the service of being dominated, which I was floored. I was like, wow, this is something that I do, that I enjoy as a normal part of my life. And then I found, you know, through different publications, there is one called the Dominatrix Directory International. It's no longer being published. For over 30 years, it was an advertising magazine for dominatrixes all over the world. And I looked through it and I saw the women, and I saw their dungeons, and I saw what they were doing, and I was just amazed by it. And decided to that I really wanted to pursue it, and I did. And now it's 18 plus years later,
right,
and it's been quite a journey.
The stereotype of men and women is that, you know, men dominate and women submit. That's sort of the historical stereotype. So a female dominatrix is obviously turning that stereotype on its head. So why do men want this, and like, how is it therapeutic?
Humans are very interesting animals. You know, men, because of society, the societal, you know, perceptions that men have to be in control, mm-hmm. men have to be dominant, managers, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's very balancing for a person. It's a natural thing for someone who is in that control. I also call it, and many people call it, top space,
mm-hmm.
because you're topping, you're managing. You know, it's balancing to surrender that control and allow someone that you trust, that you feel safe with, to have
right.
control over you. And the therapeutic aspect, that's part of it. It's very liberating to not be in control and to just release all of that control and let somebody else have control in a erotic situation. There's hundreds of thousands of men. I thought about this years ago, like, wow, you know, even before the huge surge in popularity of BDSM, which has happened in the last so many years, even prior to that, you know, there were many dominatrixes in business. And I thought, wow, you know, there are just so many of these men who want to be dominated, and in their daily lives, they might be, you know, very much in control.
Right.
But in these situations, they want to relinquish that. And
do you probably get to know these men a little bit, quite a lot. So would you say that they are in their daily lives more in control than other men, that like they're managers, A-type people, that kind of stuff?
Yes, I would, a lot of the times, but not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's such a wide spectrum of, you know, psychological situations with people. I think it's all across the board. And when we try to broad stroke things, I think that we will, you know, miss out on a lot.
Right.
Human beings are much more complicated than just, you know, black and white.
Well, but I think in a healthy sexual relationship, even if we're talking about, you know, a monogamous relationship, people may want to take on different roles at different times. The man or the woman might want to be submissive at some times because they find that erotic.
And the words, you know, some there are constructs attached to words. You know, dominating doesn't necessarily have to mean what, you know, might come to mind immediately to many. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that the bottom, the submissive, is subjugated in a denigrating or, you know, a way that they are powerless or, you know, don't have any say whatsoever. It's not like that. In my work as a dominant, my goal is to get the person that I am dominating, quote unquote, in a the most relaxed state that I can, where they are experiencing stress relief, they are experiencing actualization. It's exploratory, experimental. You know, you're challenging comfort zones. Gosh, it's
how okay. 50 Shades of Grey. How far off was that?
Well, that movie is very, you know, first of all, it marginalizes and stigmatizes BDSM greatly, and the BDSM community, they don't care for that movie much, other than the fact that it did get people talking more, and it did bring more people into, you know, asking themselves questions. And I've certainly gotten a lot more couples as clients coming to see me since that movie. But it did get people talking more. And I think that is always a good thing when we have more discussion. But, you know, you had Christian Grey, who he was abused and as a child. And they also mentioned that his mother was a prostitute and she abused him. I mean, it's just very marginalizing and stigmatizing.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't really paid a lot of attention to that, but I do remember that. And that kind of, I guess that was put in because it was saying, well, people, it was basically pathologizing domination, right? Saying that he was dominant because some bad stuff has happened, but actually he was a nice guy because he never really did anything to, I can't remember his girlfriend's name. You know, it was pretty soft in what he did. What's that?
I think it was Anastasia,
yes. That's a great name. I wanted to talk, I mean, I guess the reason I wanted to talk to you was really because there was an article about sex trafficking and your organization, ESPLERP, sort of pushing back on this. So I wanted to talk about what's the difference you see between the work you do or more classic prostitution and sex trafficking?
Well, the term sex trafficking or even human trafficking, it's really come to mean so many things, almost like the kitchen sink gets thrown in there too.
Right.
But, you know, first of all, the anti-trafficking lobby, I'll call them that, people who have jumped on board this, it's become a massive nonprofit industrial complex where, especially in the last decade, exponentially in the last 5 years, thousands, literally thousands of nonprofit organizations have popped up in every state in the United States, allegedly to deal with this epidemic, alleged epidemic in forced sex labor. And what the reality is that, I mean, there are organizations like that that have popped up in states that have never had a single case of trafficking. By legal Right. definition, trafficking is force, fraud, and or coercion.
I always thought it was like moving people across a jurisdictional boundary for some criminal with some criminal intent. So, for example, if you take, you know, poor women from Thailand and move them into the United States in order to make money use as prostitutes, that would be trafficking. But it seems like you say that much would, broader.
That definitely would be legally. in the United States, you know, you'd think that there was this massive epidemic going on in this based off of when you have thousands of organizations that are getting federal funding as well as donations, they are in a great position to push that narrative.
Right.
And, you know, hey, when you could convince the world that UFOs were going to be landing tomorrow if you had enough money and, you know, continually pushed that narrative. And that's what they've been able to do. But it's important to understand that most of these organizations are faith-based. Mm-hmm. They're Christian organizations, and they are anti-prostitution, they are anti-sex work, anti-porn, and you know what we have seen continually from these people over and over and over again is a conflation between prostitution, erotic services as a profession, and the forced labor. And, you know, you'd think there was an army of pimps out there that are, you know, kidnapping people. This is very similar to what happened in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when the Mann Act was passed. Mm-hmm. There was a campaign around what was being called white slavery. And
and it's always better if it's white women, right? Because nobody would care so much in the 1800s about a bunch of black women being trafficked, but if it was white women.
And this was very racist. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, and this is actually how the FBI became the FBI, because at the time there was the BOI, the Bureau of Investigation. There's a great book on this called Policing Sexuality. And it describes it wonderfully. But the FBI, I mean, the BOI at the time was a very small agency of less than 100 agents. But after this campaign, and just like what is happening today, you had all of these faith-based organizations working in tandem with law enforcement to push this. It was a false narrative that black men were kidnapping, I believe at that time it was European women, and bringing them into the United States and taking them, 12 and 14 year old girls. It always seems to be that age group, across state lines. And, as it turns out, they never found any evidence of that. And it was used, that legislation was used to funnel money, more funding. The FBI became the FBI, and almost overnight, they had less than 500, but it was, you know, many more hundreds more agents. And that is when the FBI became a truly nationally reaching agency. And it was off of the back of a human trafficking lie.
There's an article in the Crime Report, which was given to me by Maxine, who's one of your co-activists.
Yeah.
And there was a headline in Alaska, 1 in 4 homeless youths victim of trafficking. But it said in the article, nobody had been charged with sex trafficking in Alaska since 2008. And this article was fairly recent. And, you know, 1 in 4 homeless youths would be a lot of people. They talked about, what did they call it, like a desperation or survival sex, where homeless kids will prostitute themselves because they have no money and maybe they have a drug problem or something. But that's not trafficking.
You remind me of a study that was done by the John Jay School of Criminal Justice, focused in New York City. And, you know, heck, if you're going to pick a city to study minors in the sex trade, and they were, you know, from what I understand, trying to figure out, you know, the scope of it and what was going on there. I mean, New York City would be a pretty important city to do this in. Mm-hmm. And they spent a year, and it was very hard for them to find minors who were actually being forced. They did find miners who were working of their own volition. And that study, I think, is very important, but it is greatly ignored by the rescue industry, is the terminology that we in the erotic service provision activism realm use for this nonprofit industrial complex that has risen up in the last decade. They don't want to hear this because it challenges their narrative. But they found that over half of them were boys. Mm-hmm. They also found that 70% of these youth would have perhaps not engaged in survival sex work had there been social safety net services that they could, and 70% of them had sought services that were non-existent. Mm-hmm. And 90% were not being forced by anyone. They were working of their own volition. And that reminds me of a 15-year-old who was found during Operation Cross Country, which is the FBI. It's said to be a week-long raid. Some reports say it's 3 days. Right. That happens once a year throughout the United States in various cities. I think it's something like 128 cities engage in this FBI / police / NGO vice operation.
Right.
But this 15-year-old was found during this operation, and he was on his own, and he was trying to find a place to stay, and he was trading sex for a place to stay. So, many people, we scratch our heads and we say, well, you know, maybe if there were voluntary services where these people could go, where they don't have to be arrested, because that seems to be the DNA of the rescue industry, that you have to be arrested, you have to engage, law enforcement in order to get any services. And, that poses many problems.
Right. I see that. I think that's a pretty profound point, that if there are economic reasons, would you agree that some men and women get into sex work for economic reasons, like drug addiction or homelessness
because they need to pay their mortgage after mm-hmm. a divorce.
Right.
I've had people contact me asking me how to get into the vocation of Dom, who were middle-aged women who were divorced, who were, putting out resumes everywhere they could and not getting any work. It's economics into erotic services work.
I mean, that's one side of it. I mean, where there are huge economic inequities, and America is moving more and more into that direction, and I'm in Canada, and we're not exactly immune from that trend. There are going to be people who get into sex work just because of the economic impacts. But on the other hand, I think if we lived in a perfectly equitable society, I'm guessing there would still be a demand for sex work, and there would be men and women willing to provide those services.
There is a need for it. It really truly is a service, and there are many different reasons that the narratives that are anti-erotic services do not account for. And that's a discussion that needs to happen. Even people who get into erotic services as a profession for less than what some might think are the best reasons, they can do well as well and even enjoy it and find that it's something that they really do want to do. So you can't just broad stroke it and say, well, this person is forced by their situation, as if they, would never like it or want to do it. In fact, that's how, part of how I got into it. I was not in a good situation, and for survival, I was right. doing it. But I definitely, that is not the case today. And there are many different things. It's funny, I was handing out a pamphlet when we were fighting some legislation at one point, and I was doing some canvassing at an event, and I walked up to a woman and I handed her my pamphlet, and we got into a conversation, and she looked at me with this perplexed look, because she could tell that I was not a victim, that I was not, what in her mind, was the typical person
right.
doing erotic services. And she looked at me and she said, well, you know, do you have to do this? Is this something that you have to do? And I'm like, no, there's many things I could do, but this is something I really want to do. But it was outside of her frame of reference because she was so programmed with the narratives that all people doing erotic services are victims or exploited or, you know, in some horrible situation. And it just simply is not true.
I think a lot of societies have big problems with sex. Like you said, societies, especially religious people, are opposed to sex work. But I think a lot of societies anti-sex in general. There's sort of these idealized circumstances under which you can have sex. You've got to be married. It has to be monogamous, et cetera, et cetera. But that doesn't necessarily work for everybody. Sex is everywhere in our society. It's in advertising. It's in magazines. And yet there's also all of this political stuff against sex. I think the anti-abortion movement is also because it's a sexual function of women to have babies. And so it sort of goes against the narrative that women are supposed to stay home, get pregnant, have lots of babies, that a lot of religious people see as the ideal circumstance.
Well, you know, it's funny, this keeps getting brought up, and I think it's a big thing. We do live in a world that is hyper-sexualized. You know, the advertising companies, they learned a long time ago to, you know, use our desires, hopes, fears, whatever, in order to manipulate us into buying their products or following mm-hmm. their narrative. At the same time, that puzzle piece of humanity that is sex and all that comes with it, we have yet to really address it in a healthy, rational, reasonable way. And it is still greatly, greatly stigmatized. Yeah. And I think it's something we need to just start dealing with as you know, human beings.
Yeah, I really think people are pretty torn up about it. Like they're trying to believe two different things at one time. I mean, I think the you know, a classic example would be a very homophobic, anti-pornography, anti-abortion politician who turns out is actually having a secret gay relationship. And it's almost like this whole thing is a facade to cover up the desires that they feel really guilty about.
We see that so much. And it gets even worse, you know, when you have people that are get caught with child porn. You know, the amount of police, the amount of judges, public officials, ministers, all sorts of people who have been very loudly against porn and against prostitution. But here they are doing what they're doing. And I think you hit the nail on the head. I think there's some kind of pathology there where, you know, on one hand, you have people who definitely are bringing what I call their head trips around sexuality to the table. And that's, you know, pretty much normal. They imagine themselves doing sex work. I think that's how the human mind works, is with anything. That's how movies are so popular. You know, that suspension of disbelief and you
right.
become the characters. Well, with issues that in the world that we analyze as human beings, we will visualize ourselves, you know, even if we don't realize we're doing it, as the one engaging in it. And then, of course, there might be this revulsion, like, oh, you know, oh, that's gross. Because people bring their own head trips to the table. They need to, you know, be able to better step outside and empathize and try to understand what is beyond their personal understanding. But then you also have a group of people, a population that are definitely engaging in very unhealthy behaviors, or they're just doing, you know, they're seeing prostitutes and they just don't want anyone to know. So they, you know, with this loud anti-prostitution, it's a way for them to hide.
Would a man be seeing a prostitute because, there's a lot of married men that see prostitutes. Is this because they don't get sexual satisfaction at home? Is it because there's a different kind of relationship when you're paying for sex, that you know, you're not responsible for the woman's feelings? Like, what would be the reasons for...
You know, clients have really gotten a bad rap.
Mm.
I mean, men are getting a bad rap in many ways. There are so many reasons. We could do an entire conversation about that. And, you know, I have a lot of compassion, you know, for men. You know, the last, you know, 18 years plus that I have been doing this work, mm-hmm. I have been in thousands of intimate situations with human beings. And, you know, the first thing that many are going to probably imagine is me having sex with these people, when that is the farthest thing from the truth. You know, people want to connect. Sometimes they just want someone to be able to talk to tell all of the feelings and desires that they do not feel they can to anyone else. This goes back to the issue of humans not dealing with sexual topics as well as we need to, because we haven't developed this ability. Communication is a very important part of that. But there's lots of reasons that men will, and women and couples will seek out erotic service providers.
Yeah, I mean, how many couples can actually have open discussions about their sexual desires and fantasies, and how many feel I could never ask him or ask her that because they'd say no, or because they'd be offended, or something like that?
Well, I would say that's very common. And I'm hoping, one of the reasons I started reaching out to couples about 10 years ago as an erotic service provider, I wanted to learn you know, from that. And it's been very interesting, to say the least, to see, you know, people going through their processes and you know, couples who are communicating. But
I mean, do you see an improvement in communication in couples when you work with them in terms of their ability to communicate sexually with each other, like either verbally or non-verbally?
Well, first of all, they're able to communicate to a degree already, because there they are, you know, saying, hey, you know, let's go see an erotic service provider.
Okay. That's a big step.
But, you know, afterwards, I mean, it's, and I feel very honored to be trusted and to be mm-hmm. allowed access in these very personal situations, to be able to learn from them and to facilitate for them in a safe environment, so they can explore their feelings, emotions, and it's very important. I think it's a cutting edge form of therapeutic modality, and I imagine that it is going to expand as the years progress, and it will become much more of a legitimate service, as it should be. Because, you know, sometimes you need somewhat of a mediator to help, and you know, it goes beyond, you know, just sitting there and talking. But, you know, back to your question about, you know, why, you know, there are people who are, you know, very lonely. They really don't want to, or they don't want to be in a relationship,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but they want intimacy. They need intimacy.
Right.
You know, human beings, you know, we know that if a baby is neglected, physical
right.
touch, we know that baby is not going to be healthy. We know that they're going to suffer from a variety of, you know, mental, you know, I guess you'd call it disorders, but, you know, just lots of negatives there.
Right, right.
Who says that as human beings develop, that we, you know, once you're a certain age, you don't need touch and you don't need intimacy, you don't need to connect. Because I don't believe that's true. I think that we need, as human beings, we do need, not just want, but we need human intimacy, connection, communication, and connected to the erotic aspect.
Right. I don't normally talk about my personal circumstances, but I grew up in a family that loved me. Like, it was a very great parents, but they were not into touch. They didn't hug me, kiss me, whatever. I mean, they did when I was little, I guess, but I can't really remember that far back. Whereas, like, my aunts and uncles, especially my aunts, I had a really big-bosomed aunt, and when she hugged me, I just disappeared inside. But that was really strange to me, and it took me a while to separate it all out, because touch, there's non-sexual touch, and obviously there's sexual touch, but both are very important to human happiness. I don't think you can be happy if you are never touched by somebody in a friendly or loving way.
And I'm really big on non-sexual intimacy and touching. And, you know, like as a body worker, which, you know, that was my previous career, that is when it really hit me hard that humans are not getting as much touch as they really do need. And who knows, maybe some of the issues that we are dealing with societally right now, I mean, look at what's going on in the world. You know, when people, touch is just so important, intimacy, tenderness, it's just so important.
I think the Me Too movement has identified some really pathological men, you know, men who treat women as objects. But I'm worried that it's going to make men very wary of touching women, you know, in a non-sexual way, like a hug, you know, a kiss on the cheek, things like that. Like, I think a lot of men are now thinking, like, am I going to hug the wrong woman and turn out that I've been accused of my hug was too tight or it was too long or something like that?
Yeah, it does seem that it's going off the rails. You know, I think it's, but you know, humans do tend to do the extremes, you know.
Yes.
Hopefully they'll find that balance, that place, you know, of balance, which, you know, that's my hope.
Well, it seems like we just like lurch from one side to the other. Like, we'll, you know, in 20 years from now, we'll be talking about the importance of human touch, and then there'll be some cases of egregious sexual abuse, and then all of a sudden we'll lurch back to the, you know, when an adult touches a child, it's wrong, you know.
Which... What about all the men who have been sexually abused? Where's the movement for them?
Yes, and I mean, we did see that, you know, with, like, for example, with the Kevin Spacey things, but it seems like women now have the ability to talk about it, but I'm not sure that too many men
That's it, the talking part. That, you know, the first thing, you know, we need to become better at communicating, better at thinking, better at processing, better at talking. You know, the priorities of humans, you know, from basically right out of the womb is consumerism and career. You know,
right.
And I've said it for a long time, for years, that our priorities are really messed up. I mean, I think my personal position is that the number one priority should be our mental, emotional development as human beings.
Yes.
But how can we do that when we've got to spend almost every, you know, waking moment trying to pay rent and utilities and all the bills and for our food and it, you know, the cost of living is just so high. I mean, when you even have families, you know, both parents, unless they are wealthy, they have to work. You know, there's a lot of disconnection going on.
Right. But I mean, people do tend to have, generally have relationships, you know, whether people are married or they're a teacher or something, there, you know, a lot of jobs are relationships, but there's no Nobel Prizes for having the best, most productive relationships. Is not considered as important as your promotion or as winning a gold medal or something like that. So that somebody, man or woman, who goes through life having really positive relationships with lovers, with children, with people they work with, isn't going to get much except maybe a gold watch when they retire, if they're lucky. They're not going to get a lot of thanks during their lives, as opposed to the A-type person who ends up completely dysfunctional but running a huge corporation and everybody looks up to them because they have a lot of power and money. But they might be coming to somebody like you because they can't stand their life.
Yeah, and you know, goodness, I would like for people to be, you know, healthier. That would be be awesome. If society was healthier, you know, that would be
yes.
a good thing.
I want to talk a little bit about the legal status. Like, when it comes to what's legally called prostitution, like, what is any of it legal? Like, is the buying and the selling, are they both illegal? Like, how does that work?
Here in the United States, it is absolutely illegal. It's a misdemeanor in most instances. But I think in some certain states, if you are charged a number of times, then it becomes a felony.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not versed in the nuances of every single state. But it is illegal to purchase or buy erotic services other than the certain counties in Nevada.
Is it illegal to sell them?
Yes.
So both. So when they bust into a massage parlor, which is providing sexual services, then both the customer and the sex worker will be arrested.
Yes, but also I would say, you know, there are situations where they arrest primarily the providers while the purchasers, walk out the door.
Well, they tend to be important people, i.e. powerful men, right?
I wouldn't say power. I mean, there are a lot of just everyday people.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyday people. But the narratives of the rescue industry, they talk a lot about, they want that Nordic model, which criminalizes the buyer.
Right.
The way it works in the United States, I mean, it's even where the Nordic model has been implemented, the erotic service providers in those regions hate it, and it's very harmful to them. And the only people who seem to think that it works are the people who promote it and support
it. Well, if I was selling donuts and that was perfectly legal, but buying them was a crime, I'd be pretty pissed off when every time the police bust in, arrest all my customers, and I don't sell any donuts that day. I mean, it doesn't really matter, right? How can you have a business when your customer is getting arrested?
You're in Canada where buying is illegal, but selling is not, right?
Actually, I should have looked this up more, but I think there was a court case that basically overturned the laws on prostitution in Canada, and we could end up with a legal vacuum because it's not clear that they can actually write laws that won't violate the Constitution. I mean, that's how we ended up in Canada with no laws with abortion being legal. Abortion in Canada is technically neither legal nor illegal. There is no law about abortion because it's not possible to write one. Every one they tried got overturned. But there's some time period where the government has a year or something to try to rewrite the laws. But yeah, it's definitely not as illegal. But I wanted to ask, how does that affect sex workers in general when there's this fear of being arrested, like in terms of the safety of their work and how they work, things like that?
Well, when you do not have the benefit of equal protection under law, you know, if something bad happens to you, you can't just call the police because you could get arrested or have any of a number of issues, especially if you have kids.
Mm-hmm. Have your kids taken away?
They can be. Absolutely. You can have your kids taken away just for being involved in BDSM. You know,
right.
That happens to people.
But or being a vegetarian. I mean, it doesn't take much these days. If the child services don't like you, they don't need very much to take your kids.
But, you know, there's so many different issues. If you get arrested and it's on your record, well, you're going to have a very hard time doing any other kind of work. Because who's going to hire you? They're going to see a prostitution charge. I know of a woman who had a dismissed prostitution charge that, was being rejected for employment. And she had to, pay several $1,000s to a lawyer to get that dismissal. And thankfully, it was an option for her because there are many states where, that's not even an option, off of her record. But, a dismissed charge is just as bad as a full-on guilty.
Right.
Of the stigma. But, and then housing opportunities, you know, when these days everything is out there. Someone can look up by way of your social security number, your background check for jobs, for lots of different things. And if they see that, well, that's most likely going to block you from life opportunities of a variety. So it's very marginalizing. It's like a lifelong sentence, even though it's a misdemeanor.
I presume that you're working on your own premises, and how do you advertise without drawing the attraction of authorities?
There's not enough police. I mean, they can and budget to police the whole industry. So, you know, someone said it was about 1%. I don't know if I agree with that, but you know, it's going to be more that they target people. And so, I mean, there's nothing to stop them. You know, I have internet advertisements, but there's nothing to stop them from, you know, going after someone if they want to.
If they decide they don't like you, they could focus on you, and yeah, that could be really bad. I mean, do they tend to focus on the street prostitutes who are maybe the most obvious and easiest to round up?
The internet has changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of people are using the internet to access clients. Now, you know, of course, there are still, you know, street-based workers, but, you know, the vast majority are online. And that is why the rescue industry has been attacking our listing sites, such as Backpage.com and Redbook and Rentboy and a variety of others. You know, they're going after these internet sites, which have allowed erotic service providers to advertise, and that way they have contact with a potential client prior to meeting. They can have a, you know, discussion and vet them so that they have, you know, an understanding of who they're dealing with. When you take that away from people, that is what makes, you know, that's one way to make it not as safe for people.
I think most decent people would I mean, the way I look at it is that I don't think demand for sexual services is ever going to go away.
No.
And I don't think I want to feel that people who are providing those services are at risk of being injured or even killed by a bad client because they're forced to work in an area where they have no protection.
Well, and let's say this, you know, the primary abusers are police. You know, that needs to be discussed, and you won't hear that from the anti-trafficking rescue industry organizations, that police are having sexual contact with both minors and adults during sex trafficking investigations and then arresting them after sexual contact. We have number of police who are coercing sex from erotic service providers in exchange for not arresting, and you have officers outright raping erotic service providers. And, you know, so everybody wants to talk about the clients being the perpetrators of abuse. And, you know, it does happen. Clients are also abused, and neither do clients have equal protection under law. So both clients and the workers need to have the benefit of equal protection under law.
Right. I think in this article, it talked about how, basically what you said, but the police, they have to arrest you, they have to get you to agree to sell a sexual service. They could arrest you at that point, or yes, they could accept the sexual service and then arrest you. And that seems unethical, but apparently it said that happens a lot, and I think you're confirming that.
Well, there are officers who, police agencies, which have argued for to be able to do this. Hawaii, for instance, you know, they were defending it as, you know, something they needed to do.
Well, it's like the two policemen who raped a girl in the back of a police car
in Brooklyn.
Yeah, with handcuffs, and then said it was consensual. I don't know how you get that a girl in a police car with handcuffs on could possibly consent to
Well,
sex.
Norma Jean Almodovar, who used to be LAPD turned call girl, she even has a book, From Cop to Call Girl.
Mm-hmm.
She's been in the the fight for decades now. She wrote a book, check it out. But she has a website at policeprostitutionandpolitics.com where she has, there's a bunch of awesome information up there. But she has lists of police officers, judges, law enforcement officials, and politicians who have been caught, everything from just patronizing erotic service providers to the list of cops who have been arrested, charged with child porn, sexually abusing children, raping, murdering sex workers. It's quite a long list. And, these are the people who are in the position to arbitrarily enforce these laws, including the anti-trafficking laws. So, it's a big problem.
And also, I guess, when there is a push, like we've got to deal with sex trafficking, if there's a lot of articles written about how bad it is, then there's pressure on the police. Okay, you got to arrest more people.
Well, we have people in the anti-trafficking realm who are, wealthy, who are giving money to police agencies to do raids. So, they're not just there rooting them on, they're funding them to do
right.
it. And when you look at a lot of these, like Operation Cross Country, the big FBI,
mm-hmm.
Millions of dollars are being spent on that. 2014, it was over $67 million for this one-week raid that involved nearly 9,000 agents.
Right.
And they rescued, they call it a rescue, the real word is arrest.
Okay.
They arrested, I believe it was 168 minors. And these are 16 and 17-year-olds generally.
Right.
And then they arrested hundreds more in adults. And that's what you're seeing in all of these. Something that people need to understand is every time they hear this term sex trafficking investigation or sex trafficking sting on the news, it's really the same old prostitution stings that they have always done being called a sex trafficking sting now.
Right.
And the majority of the people who are being arrested and their lives affected are adults seeking consenting adults. Now, if they, focused on child predators, I'm going to be rooting them on.
Right.
Yes, let's do that. Let's focus on child predators. Absolutely. Do it. But they don't. Another thing is you have the vast majority of human trafficking, forced labor of any kind, is non-sex related. And in all of these other industries, farming, domestic workers,
right.
Fishing, you have all these different industries where you have human trafficking, forced labor rather, let's call it forced labor.
Slavery, if you want, essentially.
Going on. There are no task forces in mass to deal with it. There is no massive nonprofit industrial complex to deal mm-hmm. with it, talk about it. And those industries and the workers in them are not criminalized. But here we have the erotic service provision industry, which is vastly consensual workers who are not being forced.
Right.
And we have to be criminalized and our industry has to be criminalized in order to deal with any forced labor that's going on there.
Right.
See, that's the argument. We're like, no. There, we need to have a distinction. We need to decriminalize erotic services as a profession and acknowledge that erotic services as a profession is a thing.
Right.
Stop conflating forced labor with consensual erotic services as a profession.
Right. And you tried to do that in January. You had a suit which failed, but I get the feeling you haven't.
It has failed completely. You see,
okay.
It is in the Ninth Circuit right now.
Mm-hmm.
The three-judge panel did dismiss our case. However, we are now filing en banc. We are asking the entire, there, you see, there's a conflict there. The, based on the case that the judge used in the dismissal, it is from the Ninth Circuit, but that case was trumped by a more recent case.
Okay.
So basically they're referring to old law that has been, what's the word? I can't think of the word, but it's, you know, Lawrence versus Texas came after the case that they are using to dismiss our case.
Okay.
And Lawrence versus Texas knocked that case down.
Okay, so we don't have very much time left, but basically your struggle is to get, as you call it, erotic service work declared legal, just as people are trying to decriminalize.
And yes, and we're hoping that the entire Ninth Circuit is going to listen. It is a very important case. They should, especially since there's a conflict in their own district, judicial district, they really should listen to it. It should be the entire district. Otherwise, we are going to the Supreme Court next.
Okay.
And we're not going to quit fighting. This has to happen. Decriminalization, and there is a difference between decriminalization and legalization. Decriminalization puts the power in the hands of the workers, and that's where you want that power. You do not want the state to have the power. You know, the workers need to have the power to be able to negotiate their own wages and safe working conditions and be in control of their own business. And that's
right.
You know, what we want for
decriminalization. You don't want state regulation of sexual services. You want to be just small business people.
Well, we do want to be small business. You know, there might be, you know, licenses or something. I mean, but all that needs to be discussed and with sex workers, erotic service providers at the helm, and not decided by other people outside of our industry. But yeah, you know, and we know that regulatory schemes are going to come into play, but you know, we need to have the power over our labor completely. We don't want bosses such as brothels having the power.
Right.
You know, we want to have power ourselves, and that won't, legalization will not stop the arrests. And that's, we need to stop these very destructive arrests that just harm people. There's no good reason for it.
I wish we could talk longer, but we have run out of time. I'd like to thank you for joining me today, and maybe after this case is over, we can talk again.
Absolutely. You have a wonderful day. Appreciate it. I hope that there was some information there. If people would like to support the case or learn more about it, if you would provide them with the links to our sites, that would be awesome.
I'll get them those links from you via email afterwards, and I'll send you a link to the MP3 after it's posted.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye. Thank you for listening to episode 176 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.